who believes that laughter is holy and healing, and I happen to agree, so I'm going to start with something funny today. I heard about these three ministers who went out hiking together, and they got a little bit lost, and they came across this raging river. And the first minister got on his knees, and he said, "God, give me the strength to cross this river." And poof, God gave him big muscles, big arms, and big legs, and the minister jumped in, and he crossed the river in 2 hours. And the second minister, seeing this, got on his knees. I'm hilarious. Got on his knees and said, "God, give me the strength and the tools to make it across this river." And poof, he had big arms, big legs, and a canoe. And the minister gets in the canoe, crosses the river in half an hour. And the third minister, seeing all of this, gets on his knees and says, "God, give me the strength, the tools, and the intelligence to make it across this river." And poof, God made him a woman. She busted out the map, busted out the map, walked 5 minutes upstream, and used the... Sorry, guys, y'all don't use maps. You don't. May these words be to God's glory. I was listening to NPR the other day. Could I be any more stereotypically liberal? And they were having a formal debate on a show called Intelligence Squared. Personally, I think the title of the show was a little self-congratulatory, but okay. The subject at issue was, and I quote, "Who's to blame for Donald Trump?" I mean, I don't like the guy either, and this was before the Access Hollywood tape came out with all that awful stuff about women, but all I could think was, how is this useful? The reality is that the guy is running for president, which means that a large portion of the population likes what he has to say. It doesn't matter whose fault it is that he's here. In fact, maybe his presence on the national stage is a gift. Maybe it's to force us to reckon honestly with where we are as a country. In any case, the folks in the debate were talking about how the elites were to blame for the rise of the Trump. The elites elected him. The elites covered his rise in the press. The elites funded his campaign. And then one debater said what I was thinking. The elites are someone different for everybody. For middle America, there are folks like Obama with his Harvard degree. For me, they're the political insiders who make the laws I don't understand, but which dictate what I eat, my rights as a citizen, my rights as a woman. For still others, the elites are me, with my master's degree and my stable upbringing and my general sense of entitlement. One of the debaters exclaimed that he was one of the elites. "I'm the editorial director of the Washington Post, for crying out. I'm as elite as it gets," he said. Everyone can blame the elites with equal vitriol, because no one agrees on who exactly they are. They're a stand-in for those mysterious people who have more power than we do, who affect our lives without our consent. They're the puppeteers, politicians, they're them. It's a funny thing we do as humans. When we're afraid, we often look for an amorphous group of people to blame for our insecurity. When we feel powerless, we look for someone who appears to have the power to alter our lives, whether that's the power to make laws, or the power to affect the economy by creating jobs, or the power to change our education system by sending our kids to our schools. And we blame them for the changes we didn't make, but which affect us all the same. Often they're in some exclusive club. Often they have a different skin color or religion than we do. But they are always fundamentally unlike us. And the more powerless we feel, the more intense our dislike for the group we believe is to blame, as the NPR show called it. Jesus was a man who was acutely aware of power dynamics. In fact, they were kind of his native language. Those in power tried to have him killed in the first year of his life, the whole thing with King Herod, and he understood that the way to get respect in his own religious tradition was to know it, backwards and forwards, so much so that he was able to impress his elders by teaching in the temple when he was 12. Jewish society in time was very stratified, and the Roman Empire ruled with an iron fist. Jesus knew how social power worked. And what did Jesus do with all his knowledge? He brought people together. He learned the rules so he could break them. In Jesus' time, the word leprosy referred to any contagious skin disease, and anyone who was sick was forced to live in communities of other sick people, away from their family and friends. They were often beggars on the outside of town, isolated and dependent on the kindness of others. For Jews, people with skin diseases were ritually impure. They could not participate in a life with God. So these 10 lepers who approached Jesus, not only were they socially isolated from their families and friends, but they were prohibited from participating in the life of faith because of their uncleanness. They knew this, and they knew Jesus was a Jew, so they didn't approach him, and he did not touch them, which is unusual in his ministry. But with a word, he healed them. With only a word, with only his connection to the power that makes all things new, he healed them. Or rather, they were healed because they took his word for their condition. When he said, "Go show yourselves to the priests," meaning, go show them you're okay, that it's time for you to be accepted into society, they didn't say, "But Jesus, we're lepers, we're unworthy. Why would we show the authorities how unclean we are?" They know. What would Jesus have said? "I know what you were, but I'm telling you what you are." No, the lepers go on their way, and it is in their going that they are healed. They act on what Jesus implies about their wholeness, that they are ready, that they are worthy, that they should proceed as though they are already accepted by God. Jesus says, "You are worthy," and they believe him, and in so doing, they are healed. And who has the presence of mind to thank Jesus for what he's done? Well, interestingly, it's the Samaritan. It's the foreigner. Again, remember, Jesus knows power, and the Jews generally did not associate with those who were not part of their clan. Now, don't judge them. We're all tribal to one degree or another, and if you don't believe me, ask yourself why, even today, you can't seem to talk with your parents or your friends with different political beliefs without getting upset. I do it. Freaks me out. As far as Jesus was concerned, he was not obligated to help or even speak to the Samaritan, and yet he does. The fact that the foreigner, the immigrant, is the one whose gratitude is made manifest in the text, that's important. It speaks to us about the themes of Jesus' ministry. When I was 12, my dad remarried, and she happened to be a Mexican woman from a family of migrant workers who had worked her way up to being the principal of a school on the south side of Chicago. She was tough, and I liked her. I loved that when her family got together, they all spoke Spanish and hugged a lot. That was weird for me as a Midwesterner. I was like, why is everyone hugging? I don't know what to do. I loved that when her family got together, they all spoke Spanish, and how my cousins had quinceañeras at 15, and how when she made breakfast on weekends, it was always hot tortillas, refried beans, and roasted garlic, and how obsessed she was with chili peppers as a sign of her Mexican heritage. We had lights, and we had t-shirts, lots and lots of chili peppers. I especially loved getting to know about the Day of the Dead festival, sugar skulls and marigolds. But because I was a teenager, I'm like, I'm not going to learn your stupid language. Spanish. And my stepdad was Cuban. It would have been so easy for me to learn Spanish so fast. I was a kid, and it would have taken only a few months of speaking it at home. And I missed my chance. Because I saw her in a position of power, I was a little afraid. And I never really let myself benefit from her presence. Even though I had been involved in the decision for my dad to remarry, he asked my brother and I if we were okay with it. I always felt a power differential, and so I was always a little uneasy. I always resisted letting her change me, even though now I know she would have changed me for the better. I would love to be able to say that I can't understand Trump's racism and phobia about foreigners, the whole build a wall thing, but if we're honest with ourselves, we all have it. That's why we need Jesus as a reminder that the other is not evil. They're not trying to take what we have. They want what we do. They want healing and acceptance and community. In fact, they want what we perhaps take for granted, the right to vote, the ability to provide for their families, access to education, shelter, freedom from drug lords or corrupt police, which is on a continuum. It's natural to be afraid that others will take our resources, but the fact that so many of us come to this country may be a reminder. We here in the States have an excess of almost everything. And I know it doesn't feel that way sometimes. Sometimes we feel the squeeze, we feel the scarcity. So I'd like to challenge us to consider something. In 2012, the Journal of Social Psychology performed a study in which participants were shown pictures and films containing death. And then immediately afterwards, they were shown advertisements. The researchers noticed that exposure to violence increased participants' desire to buy the products they were shown immediately afterwards. The researchers stated, to quote the study, that existential anxiety, which death reminders activate, may reinforce materialistic desires. In other words, the more afraid we are, the more in danger of death or loss, the more we want to shop. So what does this mean about the interests of the media, which is funded by ad sales, and the worldview it might behoove them to promulgate? Now, I'm not judging or saying we should only watch SpongeBob. I'm a Game of Thrones fan, don't tell anybody. And there's plenty of death and existential anguish there. But it may help us to remember that our economy, to a large extent, is bolstered in direct proportion to how scared we as Americans are. This is not to say that the world is a perfect place, but it helps to remember that there are those who benefit from your fear, and inflating it only helps them. They don't consider your peace of mind to be their responsibility. Or perhaps we're afraid because we're immigrants. This area of the world in particular is flooded with folks not just from overseas, but from other areas of the country. For example, on Thursday, I, a Chicago native, took Zumba from a Colombian, chatted with my other teacher, who's Japanese, picked up my laundry from a Mexican guy, and went home to my husband, who was born in New York but grew up in North Carolina. It's true. I do improv with a guy who's constantly bragging that he knows how to drive a combine because he's from Kansas, who is married to a woman who grew up in the South Bay whose parents are Egyptian. Being an immigrant, even from one state to another, means sacrifice. It often means scarcity or living out of boxes or suitcases and the ability to put your discomfort on the back burner so you can fight for a space at the table, as many of us do, for example, with housing in the South Bay. My mom used to tell my brother and I that we had no idea how lucky we were because we spoke the same language as our teachers, when half the kids at her Chicago school only spoke Spanish. Being an immigrant acquaints us mightily with the knowledge that nothing is guaranteed. So when we see yet more immigrants and we are aware of how scarce resources can feel, how hard we had to fight for our security, no wonder we resist. No wonder we guard what we or our parents have fought for. No wonder we're afraid to share. We ourselves often feel like we just made it by the skins of our teeth. Truthfully, we're all immigrants, even if we've lived in the same house all our lives, because we are all on a journey we've never been on before. Unless you're in which case, you probably don't remember your previous life anyway. For most of us, at some point in our lives, there is a crisis which forces us to begin our pilgrimages into who we will become. Our parents die, and we must migrate from the state of being the younger generation to being the older one, from feeling somewhere inside like we're always children into feeling like we are now the adults. Or we discover something about ourselves, and we must walk the path from who we used to be into the new selves, which itch and hurt and are so amorphous in the beginning that we're not sure who will be when this is all over, whether our friends will still love us, whether our church will accept us. We find what we're passionate about, and pursuing that passion takes us places we were sure we would never, ever go, like me right now. We are all, to some extent or another, travelers. We are all wandering down the road, seeking healing, sometimes feeling like aliens and foreigners and immigrants, hoping that when Jesus sees us, he will call us whole and we'll be able to believe him. Because God does call us whole. God calls us God's people, even as broken as we are. And as Maya Angelou said, as soon as healing takes place, go out and heal somebody else. As soon as healing takes place, go out and heal somebody else. Oftentimes, we get stuck in thinking about what we don't have, what we've lost. And this verse in Jeremiah, in which God speaks to the people who have been carried off, is a reminder to guard our thoughts this way, to grow where we're planted. Remember, these were people whose lives were destroyed, who were essentially kidnapped by their enemies and forced to settle in a foreign land. Not only were they immigrants, they didn't even want to be immigrants. But God says to them, make the most of what you do have. I know this isn't ideal. I know this isn't what you expected for your life, but do what you can. You can have a family. It's one of the greatest gifts in the world. You can provide for your loved ones, another true blessing to which Many don't have access. You can seek the welfare of this new place, which is now your home. So focus on what you can do, not what you cannot. This afternoon after the service, Susan will be giving a prop talk about the upcoming statewide ballot measures for this election season. Voting and being politically active is one way we can focus on what we can do instead of what we cannot. It's how we can make the land we do live in, whether we grew up here or came from elsewhere, into the best version of itself that it can be. It's how we can, quote, seek the welfare of the city and how we can, by extension, find our own welfare also. It's a truism that when we seek only our happiness, we don't find it. But when we seek the betterment of all, we find our peace. I won't pretend I'm not scared. I am. What if I lose my insurance and one day I have an asthma attack and it kills me? What if I can never afford a house? What if our parents get sick and we have to empty our savings because medical care is so expensive? And when someone comes along and tells me that the problem is Donald Trump or immigration or the elites, it's tempting for me to sink into bitter helplessness and wait for someone else to make the world the way I want it. But that's not helpful to me or to the world. That's refusing to learn Spanish despite others and then being deprived of a whole language that I now would love to speak. I have to adjust to the world, not the other way around. And the way I do that is by remembering that there's one thing that never changes, and that's God's love for me. When I wander along dusty roads, alone or in pain, I continually encounter Jesus because he never stops looking for me. And when he sees me, he calls me worthy. He calls me healed. He calls me clean. All I have to do to reap the benefits of wholeness is to begin my journey anew, as though I am already healed, even if I don't feel healed or whole quite yet. All I have to do is proclaim by my actions that I believe what God says about me, not what the world pours into my ears and eyes about how afraid and how lacking I am. I'm going to leave you with another quote by Maya Angelou, because often during election seasons, it can feel like the banality of evil is right around the corner, not just with the other candidate, but in general. It's overwhelming, and we wonder what our attitude should be. Angelou says, "Let gratitude be the pillow upon which you kneel to say your nightly prayer, and let faith be the bridge you build to overcome evil and welcome good." Can we build a bridge and not a wall? Can we admit that our fear of the other comes from our knowledge of what otherness feels like in our own lives? And can we, as people of faith, let our gratitude to God guide our thoughts, our words, and our actions? I believe we can. I believe we have in the past. And I believe we will. Amen and amen.